Welcome to Horse First with Lockie Phillips, a podcast about paying closer attention to the horse, to the work that we do with horses, and paying attention to what's actually happening in front of us. Not what looks good, not what we've been told looks good, because sometimes we slow down and sometimes we speed up, but we don't pretend. I'm Lockie Phillips. Let's begin. Today, we have the good fortune to be joined by Gillian Kreinbring. Gillian has dedicated her career to bringing together classical horsemanship, functional anatomy, and modern science, always with one question in mind. How do we help horses move with greater health, longevity, and freedom? Her work is grounded in years of study with respected mentors, formal research in equine movement and posture, and a commitment to carrying forwards the best of the old masters whilst remaining willing to revise what no longer serves the horse. Today, Gillian and I talked about discernment, revision, our histories, and the responsibility of deciding what we preserve from tradition and what we might leave behind. I really enjoyed getting to know Gillian and really enjoyed this conversation with her, and I hope you do too. Gillian, welcome to the podcast. I'd like to welcome Gillian Kreinbring to the podcast for the first time. Welcome, Gillian. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you. I am very honored to be here.
The honor's all mine. So let's get right to it. For anyone who doesn't know who you are and what you do, could you give us an overview of your foundations and your lineage with horses to this point today?
I will try to keep it short. It's like 50 years of history. So I just put my age out there. I was really lucky. I grew up in a horse loving family. So, you know, my mom rode while she was pregnant with me. And so I literally feel like I've been riding horses since I was in the womb. I just was very fortunate. And when I was younger, I would say, you know, before the age of 9, we just loved our horses. You know, I had that like untethered freedom with horses, you know, no instruction, just being with the horses. You know, my parents bought and sold horses. We did a lot of trail riding, spent a lot of time, believe it or not, in a sale barn. And I was an only child. My parents were kind of wild hippies. So my best friends were my ponies and my horses. So those first 9 years of my life were just blissful, that sense of freedom where you're not shaped by somebody else's ideas or views or opinions. It was just horse time. And then my parents got a little bit more involved in the industry when my father purchased a stallion. So then it really changed the tone of how we interacted with our horses, from enjoying our horses as a passion and as a pastime and a hobby, to then changing it to a business model. And that for me was really, even as a child, that was a super huge paradigm shift, because things suddenly started to become a little bit more serious. So Dad bought a bunch of brood mares, and we raised babies, and we raised quarter horses and paint horses and stock horses. And, you know, what happens when you start raising young stock is you have to have a way to market those horses. And I think that's the real shift, is at that point, you know, back in the day, when you started to raise foals, it was literally referred to as a foal crop. So they became friends to becoming seen more as livestock and seen more as business. And then that's when we started on our competition journeys. And, you know, as a child, I had a lot of really wonderful ponies that I showed, which was great. And so I showed literally from like the age of 9 all the way through high school, all the way through college, up into my mid-20s. And in that time, I also got to train and live and work in Germany when I graduated from college, which was really the first time that I was introduced to classical dressage notions. Otherwise, you know, I grew up in the Western world. So I can think of so many major like paradigm shifts in my own journey. And something that, you know, during those years of learning how to quote unquote train a horse. You know, you're young. You know, I was very arrogant because I won things. So I thought I knew a lot. And so my head was much bigger than the amount of knowledge that was actually inside of it. You know, it's funny how you especially in your 20s, you prescribe yourself under the guise of I must be somebody because I've won something. And when I was training in Germany, was the first time, Lockie, that I noticed when I would go get my horses to work for the day, and I'm using the word in that context in the past, work, when my horses started to walk away from me. And that had never really been my experience before. But I had never been under that pressure before to feel like I had to train horses using the only techniques that I had ever learned, which was 100% based in domination and subjugation. I didn't know anything different because that is how I was raised and taught to train horses. But there was something internally during that time in Germany when I started to notice the horses not wanting to be with me. And for the first time in my life, I started not to enjoy being with horses. And I was very lucky because at, you know, the ripe old age of 23, I had this inkling in my head that says, I want to be involved in the horse industry, but I don't want to be involved in it in the way that I have to make my bread and butter by training other people's horses. And to train a horse to fit a trend just so that you could win a ribbon, some recognition, and money. So I packed up my bags and I moved back to the United States. And I didn't really know what my path was, but I did know that there was a different way because of how I was with the horses when I was a child. And I somehow wanted to return back to that feeling. And then, you know, it's funny how the universe works. I had to establish in the United States, you have to live in a state for a year in order to get the discounted price to attend a state university. So I took a year to establish residency in Wisconsin, which was the state that I wasn't born in. And the only thing I really thought I knew how to do was train horses to keep me afloat during those years. So in that year, I took some more horses in training as I was establishing residency. And I had a lady who sent a horse into training, and it was, you know, a good family friend, also very much involved in the competition world. And it was one of those situations where they brought a six-year-old stallion to me with the request of, this horse needs to be pretty solid walk, trot, canter in 30 days. And I thought, I could do that. I've done that before, you know, this kind of big-headed kid that really didn't know anything. And long story short, I didn't have an arena. And I was riding up in this big field, and you know, and for years it had been farmed, so there was a lot of these furrows in the land. And the lady who owned the horse had made the trek from the barn up to top of this hill to take a video, sales video of this horse that I had in training for 30 days. And so when I went to go ask the horse up to a canter, you know, quite honestly, Lockie, I was probably more concerned with how I looked. Being filmed than I really was about how Rocky was moving and being caught on camera. But in my arrogance of trying to perch myself up there and look good, I dropped a rein. And I thought, oh, no big deal. You drop a rein. But the problem was that this was in an open field, and about 10 feet ahead of me, there was an old barbed wire fence that had been grown up in weeds. And I knew that, you know, you have one of these, oh, crap moments. And I'm like, well, I have to make a decision. Either I'm going to stay on Rocky and he's going to hit that fence and get tangled up, or he's going to, you know, come to the fence, put the brakes on, do a 180, take off, or I could swallow my pride and do an emergency dismount. So I chose option 3. And when I did that, upon landing on the ground, I heard a snap, which was my ankle. And then that made me buckle. And then I flipped and I flipped and I flipped and I heard another snap and I broke my back. And I have to say that even though that was a major trauma for me, it was probably the best gift I had ever been given. So I had to wait quite a while for the ambulance to come. So, you know, laying in that grass, and it was so peaceful. Shock is amazing. So I was totally in shock, but it was very peaceful. And I probably had the most transformational moment up to this point in my career at then, because I realized that everything I had been doing with horses to that point, other than when I was a child, was 100 driven by my ego. And I also realized that even though I had been doing horses for 23 years, that I really didn't know anything. Meaning, sure, I knew technique, and not even good technique, you know, dominance-based techniques to subjugate horses. But I really didn't know anything about horses, about who they were as a species. So then that took me about 6 months to heal from that accident. And it was in that time that I became very clear about what I wanted to study in my graduate program. And I had taken my first lesson 6 months later after that accident with a woman, and her name was Peggy Cummings. And I went to that lesson, and I went to go get on a horse. And Peggy said, oh, no. We never get on a horse without taking time to get to know the horse, doing some work on the ground, establishing some sort of relationship with the horse, and more importantly, helping the horse's body and mind to be prepared to carry the weight of a rider. And so I started to hear all this jargon that I really didn't really understand, even though I had heard all the terms, you know, all my life about self-carriage, collection, on the forehand, you know, all these basic terms. And Peggy, you know, was instructing me about how you can help horses develop their bodies from the ground to help them carry the weight of the rider so that we could not only help horses live a longer life, not just about longevity, but about their vitality through their longevity. Meaning, you know, okay, so your horse lived to be 30 years old, but you had to retire the horse at 12 because some human used them up, you know, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. What she was trying to mentor me with is that longevity means that the horse is also vital in their mind, body, and spirit. And so that moved me so deeply that's what became my study at that time at the university, which was to really understand horses in terms of their bodies and how the horse can move in a way that works with their structure and not against their structure to carry a rider, which, you know, so often they don't have a choice in the matter. Human says, I ride horse. Horse has no choice. So then I feel a huge responsibility to learn how can I do that in a way that actually increases the quality of life for the horses. And so that's really been my journey ever since, is learning just how to be a better steward. First by learning about functional anatomy, and then secondly about the mind, and then now layering in, you know, understanding of, you know, neuroanatomy. And, you know, it's just one layer on top of another layer on top of another layer. So there's not like any one set, you know, magic button like, oh, okay, I'm going to learn about functional anatomy. I'm going to have all the answers. It's just one very tiny slice of a greater pie. And that's, you know, where I continue to this day. I realize that my ideas, my opinions, what I teach is always going to be changing. You know, it's always going to be dynamic. And that's where I'm at now. You know, the old cliche is the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know anything. And that's clearly where I still am today. It's like, I question myself all the time. Like, well, is that right? Or I can poke holes in what I think I know, you know? So yeah, that's my background. And ever since then, I've been teaching courses on functional anatomy, rhythm, relaxation, and just anything that I feel, you know, might help us humans be better for the horses.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. The Dunning-Kruger effect is real.
Huge.
And painful.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. And so you describe this event with Rocky, the 6-year-old stallion that came to you for a 30-day start to get walk, trot, canter, causing you to make an emergency dismount, leading to broken ankle, broken back. And that event was the beginning of a cascade of changes. But it wasn't, well, to say it's the beginning, maybe it was the end of a process that then started a new beginning. Because it sounds like before you broke your back, there were multiple accumulative questions in your mind, in your body, in your heart about what you were doing. And when you find yourself on your back with a broken back, that's a wake-up call. And I think a lot of people can relate to that, maybe to the extreme point of, I broke my back, that was my wake-up call. And some people never get to the broken back phase. And this is where we see sort of two sides of this issue now. This is what I see. We see a lot of people who feel overwhelmed now about the volume of competing information and voices that are clawing at them in the horse world, on social media, from every direction, every day. People who feel conflicted about that because information overload. And you and I both are two of those voices that are contributing towards that information overload. We've got to acknowledge that. And there are people who absolutely require the availability of that information in order to move the needle and to take the next step. And this is really all about discernment, people's ability to be able to look at information, think critically without being judgmental, and make a clear decision about what to do now. For you, Jillian, I'm really curious, what was discernment to you back then when you fell off Rocky? And how might that be different for you today, sitting in front, you self-declare, 50 years old, congratulations, I'd like to be you when I grow up. Thank you. Yeah. So how has that changed for you, the idea of discernment, to cut the mustard and make a decision?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the version of myself then was that there really wasn't much discernment, at least as it pertained to the horse. My discerning moments were more about me. Mm. You know, how can I train to pretzel this horse, to contort this horse, to subjugate this horse, to move in a way that I know is going to win me a ribbon? So my discernment was more about me. What do people think of me as a trainer? Do they think I'm talented? Will I need to be in the top three? Otherwise, I don't get more horses in training. And if I don't get more horses in training, how am I going to pay my own student loans? So there really wasn't a lot of discernment about the horses. And that is, you know, it's not something that I'm proud of, but it is a part of my journey. Now, I think it's fascinating that you use the word discernment, because I use that word quite frequently when I teach. But before we go to discernment, I'd like to just circle the wagons back around and look at another word that is passed around in the equine industry, and that's this idea of horsemanship, right? So, well, what is horsemanship? Well, if you think of the last word, the suffix of the word, it's ship. And if I think about other words that have that suffix, I think about friendship, I think about stewardship,
guardianship,
fellowship. And I think for me now, this shapes my discernment in how I feel about it today. And that is that horsemanship is about making a commitment in terms of caring for something through the ability to acquire skills and acquire knowledge and experience in studying both theory and application so that I can care for something like the horses in a better way. And on my journey of learning about functional anatomy and all the different slices of the pie, when we learn that information, it helps me make discerning choices for my horses in terms of what's maybe for their always for their betterment, right? Helping them be safe, setting up environments for not just their physical body, but their mental capability to be kind, safe, and fair. Fairness is a huge thing because a lot of people are not fair to their horses. So, you know, my area that I focused my study on was functional anatomy. And that was about learning about the horse's scaffolding and, more importantly, how that horse can learn to move that scaffolding in a way that if a person rides them, we're not causing harm and breakdown to the body, but rather we're helping the body build and become stronger. So, you know, when I first started teaching that, and believe it or not, this is my 18th year of traveling on the road, teaching functional anatomy. 18 years. And talk about information overload. You see, when I first started teaching this, we didn't have this thing called Facebook or social media. where the entire horse industry was getting their information from. So it was very nice not to have all those other influences that created confusion within many people's learning journey. So for me, I could look to, at that time, functional anatomy as a benchmark to help me make more discerning choices for the betterment of horses. And then I get another layer. Let's say we're learning more about their neuro and their brain chemistry. Okay, so now you learn that layer. You layer that on top of the functional anatomy, and now you make different choices to ensure that the horse has good relationships, good care, a healthy, happy life. And you know, you can't ferret the mind away from the body or the body away from the mind. And humans want a recipe. They always want a recipe. They want to break it down. But whether you're looking at functional anatomy or biomechanics or neuroanatomy or biotensegrity or any of these fields of study, they're just models. They're a field of study that offer models to help us understand. They're not absolutes. And I think that's where a lot of humans get stuck. They learn something and then they're an absolutist about it. And it doesn't leave room for what I really like to have implemented in when I spend time with horses now. And that is the art of compromise and close approximations. Instead of becoming myself or my horses a slave to technique. Technique's important, but we have to move beyond technique. And I think we all come to this place at some point in our lives where technique flows into art, artistry, you know, and there's a very fine line between technique and art. One informs the other. And so that's where I find myself now, especially with so much information, as you were saying, like I get overloaded. I just can't go on Facebook because I get overwhelmed. And then, oh, I might start doing that dreaded thing called comparing, you know, compare and despair. So I try just to stay in my lane. And then when learning opportunities present themselves to me, then, you know, I try to be discerning if whether or not I want to go down the rabbit hole or not. Mm. Long answer to your question.
No, it's a beautiful answer. I'm curious, you mentioned how at that moment with Rocky, and leading up to it, you say that you didn't have much discernment for the horse.
Thank you.
You okay?
Mm-hmm.
You're all right.
Coffee went down the wrong tube.
Mm-hmm. Okay, he's all right. I'm just looking out the window because I've got a horse who's recovering from pyroplasmosis, and I can't take my eyes off him. Yeah.
Good.
Okay.
Glad you can see him.
So in that moment, you're on your back and it's broken. And you mentioned that you didn't have much discernment for the horses and that your discernment was centered around the self. How can I be perceived better? How can I have more clients? How can I be more successful? What do other people think of me? And there's a difference between discernment and decision-making. And in order to be a competition rider at the level you were at, it does require a constant series of decisions, at least actions. Whether those actions were totally conscious or not, we could debate on another day about the consciousness of decision-making. I think that would take us into the weeds a little bit too far today.
Maybe.
But I'm just nodding to that. But we're still making decisions every day with horses. I'm curious, if you say that there was no discernment at that time, who was informing the decision-making? Was there a broader cultural trend that you were soaking in that was laying down decisions already made for you, and all you had to do is step into the next thing and step into the next, like a series of boxes pre-made for you to step into? Was it a cultural phenomenon? Were there specific individuals? We're not trying to judge or cast names against anyone, but was there a specific individual who was perhaps coercing you in a certain direction or pushing or putting guardrails that kept you locked into systems that we could argue were abusive? I'm really curious, who, where were the decisions coming from if there wasn't discernment for the horse?
Yeah, I was very much shaped by the Western culture and raised in part by cowboys, people who kind of had two tracks within their own cowboy culture. One was that the horse was extremely valued, but the horse was a tool to accomplish a job. Let's say moving cattle, riding fence lines, branding calves. And so there was this track where horses were a job. They were intended to do a job. And so it was less about how a horse was trained and more about how quickly could the training move along so the horse could do the job.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But in some ways, those horses were treated now, in when I reflect back, better, because they needed the horses to be sound of body and mind to do the job that they had for the horse.
Mm.
And then I went into another channel of training horses within the horse industry for, let's say, the American Quarter Horse Association, where when I started to compete, then I found trainers that would mentor me, let me come, you know, spend 2 or 3 months with them, where they taught me how to train horses for 2-year-old Western Pleasure Futurities.
Goddamn.
Or to get horses ready for the 3-year-old futurities. And so it was still a business model, but the horse's job was to be competitive and to win. And so those were my humble beginnings. And so based on what these people taught me in terms of how to train horses is what I used as a barometer for what my decision-making was in terms of how I would train the horse to prepare it for this discipline on this timeline.
Mm-hmm.
And I was never allowed to keep a horse after the age of 4. They started at 18 months or started as a baby. They were weaned. They were put into a box stall. It was horrific. They were fed up. So they were fat, they were slick, and those little babies had to stand square. They had to walk, they had to trot, they had to square up, they had to be judged, they had to go to shows, they were weaned at 3 months. Then those babies were prepared the next year for lunging them in the lunge line fraternities. And then those babies were prepared for the 2-year-old Western Pleasure fraternity classes, which was where all the money was. And then the really good ones maybe went on to the maturity, at 3 and 4, and then they were gone. Yeah, they're mature. And so that is where I made my decisions from, was that foundation.
Mm.
And then that is what completely changed.
So you were indoctrinated 100%. By a system that existed before you arrived. Like so many people are still in that system. And then this is reinforced by social norms, family ties, financial investment, and everywhere you look, left, right, and center, this cultural framework is reinforced as correct, nothing wrong with it. This is the way the world works because it's its own echo chamber. Mm-hmm. And that world becomes more and more insulated, more and more cloistered, less external information penetrates into that environment. If it does, it's very quickly shut down or shunned from those mm-hmm. environments. And this cultural framework is not just a back then problem. It's very much a right now issue and will continue. And I'm under no delusions that I'm going to have any impact on that whatsoever. That's kind of a dead end street in that I can kind of put a period on that sentence and say, I'm not going to have any impact on it. So that kind of leads to the discernment of what to do now. Who are we working with? You know, will it take many people to break their backs for them to change? And for some people, a broken back would lead to a reinforcement of the same system. Through self-shame, it was my fault. I didn't use the system that's available to me properly, or it's the horse's fault. It was a bad horse. It was a bad moment. It was the arena's fault. It was the footing's fault. It was the tax fault, whatever the storyline is. And, you know, my heart breaks, not just my mind, not just my body. My heart breaks for not just the horses in that system, but for the people. And maybe someone somewhere is listening to this podcast. I'm often people's dirty little secret. They kind of listen to me when no one's watching. And I hope I'm listening. They're listening. If someone's listening and you need like a lifeboat, all you have to do is send an email. All you have to do is reach out and say, I don't even know how to say this, but I want out and I can't tell that to anyone around me, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just want anyone listening to know that I would declare myself a safe for an exit strategy if anyone needs support and assistance to exit those systems. Mm. But, and I'd like to step past that a little bit if you can. This is a little bit of a curveball question. Jillian, in your opinion, where does feel end and knowledge begin? You spoke a little bit about, mm-hmm. you know, technique and artistry, and I'm kind of asking that same question. In your opinion, where does feel end and knowledge begin? Or where does knowledge end and feel begin? Or art?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's really a yin and a yang, really. Like, I'm not sure one can exist without the other.
Mm-hmm.
I can only speak of really my own experience with this. I would say, you know, when you're making those discerning choices, you know, we think that we only rely on our intellect, but really there's also discernment that comes from the gut, where there is a deeper knowing, maybe even on a cellular level or epigenetics or something. Like, there's a knowing that many people have about what is just right and what is just wrong, but then society or systems steer us away from what we kind of know in our gut. So I would say when I was a child, I had so much feel of the horse, feel for the horse, right?
Feel with.
And then feel with the horse. And then you're put into a system which takes you a little bit out of feel and into here. And in my experience is that when I got really trapped in here,
your mind,
I stopped feeling. And that was a very, very emotionally painful process for me, being somebody who had feel. And then I thought I had lost the feel when I started to learn about technique. And it reminds me of the story of, and I can't remember the name of the gentleman, but he was a violin player. He was a child protege. Like, he picked up a violin and he could just play so beautifully through feel of the music, you know, the feel of how his body worked with the instrument. It was so natural and so full of feel. And then he talked about when he went to college, then he started to learn about the technique, you know, how to posture, how to hold the violin, how to use the bow, how to read music, and all of these things. And he talked about it was so painful for him because he lost that quality to his music that he had, that he played when he was younger, because then he became very stiff and trapped by the technique. And then it was about, you know, fast forward about 20 years later, where he started to realize that playing with the sense of feel came back to him. And he also had the technique, and therefore he had the ability then to actually teach what it was that he was doing. And he talked about that as a kind of like a cycle of mastery. And so, not that I'm masterful at all. I make mistakes every single day. And every time I teach, I always say, I'm just teaching truth for the moment, because I could learn something today that will teach, that will, you know, completely change what I teach tomorrow. So I went through that process of, after the accident is when I first started to learn through these incredible teachers that came into my life, the use of my body, you know, how to be in touch with my own body, to be in touch with my own mind, my own emotions, how to be learning about why you're applying a technique as opposed to just being told do this technique, but why am I doing this technique, how to do it, and why it's important. And so I would say that the last 25 years, I've been really focused on learning all the different techniques. So, for example, let's just take something like lateral flexion. Okay, if you only have one way of helping a horse find that motion at the AO joint, and that technique doesn't work, the human tends to get frustrated, or they get angry, or whatever the gamut of emotions is that they go through. But if we learn several different ways of guiding the horse to find this movement, then we have a lot of options on the table. So Moshe Feldenkrais always used to say, if you only have one way of achieving something, it's really primitive. If you have two ways of achieving something, it's still primitive, but better than only one way. But if you have three ways of asking or guiding for the same thing, then suddenly you start to realize you have endless possibilities. So when it came to this realization that I was becoming a slave to the technique and I was making my horses a slave to the technique is when I really started to lighten up within myself and have that sense of awe again like I had as a kid, that sense of curiosity, the sense of it's okay if it's not perfect, the sense of saying, hey, you know what? We're just starting to play with this, and a close approximation is more than enough. No more drilling, no more pressure about finding perfection. It starts to blend all together, and that's where the line between a technique and art for me starts to come into play, is when you allow yourself to make mistakes, you allow yourself to be curious, you allow yourself to be okay with the slightest try, you're okay with the fact that it might take 15 years to achieve this thing that you think you want to achieve, but really it's in those quiet moments, that moment that nothing else exists except for just those beautiful moments between you and the horse. Everything else falls away, and in that moment somehow the horse elevates you, right? If we're going to be honest, why do we do stuff with horses? We still are doing things with horses because there's something in it for us, whether it's an intellectual thing, a spiritual thing, a physical thing, what have you. The horse are still giving us something. And we keep coming back, I think, to what is it really that the horses are teaching us about ourselves and reflecting who we want to be or who we don't want to be. You know, when I go ahead. Yeah.
No, you go ahead. I'm fascinated and enthralled. Go ahead.
I think when as an adult, if you had that chance as a child to have that untethered freedom with a horse, when you come back to that as an adult, it's just so liberating. And you get to a place where it doesn't matter what the rest of the world thinks. What matters is that relationship you have with the horse. And relationship is about thirds. It's a third about the horse, it's a third about me, and it's a third about a relationship. And I think finding that homeostasis is a really important place to find within us, because I think that's where growth happens. And if we can bridge that growth that we learn from horses to other areas of our life, then it becomes even more meaningful. It helps us connect to the grander universe, to the natural world in general. And so I think that's important.
You know, what I hear you speaking to already from several perspectives that really excites me is your acknowledgement of the cultural systems at play and the way they inform our horsemanship and our relationship to our work with horses. And one of the cultural systems that's at play everywhere we look, it's at play in your supermarket, it's at play in your street signs, it's in your upholstery, and it's in your horsemanship. It's kind of everywhere. Is this system of sort of abstract, monolithic perfection that free floats in everything, where there's this idea of severing yourself from your body, from the truth of your body, from the word of your body, from your emotional state, severing yourself from yourness to everything around you, and you become this abstract, individual, floating thing that in this pie in the sky perfection, and everything else is a slave to that. And this is in society everywhere. And it's the difference between someone who can feel their way through something and people who try to think or force their way into things. And I see you contributing to that change and that revision of horsemanship from your perspective. And that really excites me, because it's the same area of tension that I've really planted myself, pun intended, planted myself in it and growing roots, but not just roots, mycelial connections to everything around me. And not just mycelial, it's in the air, fully realizing that it's all interconnected. And I'm not seeking a monolithic perfection. I'm seeking a greater connectedness to everything all the time. And
100.
I'm slowly developing very very haphazardly through multiple sequences of mistakes, developing a nose like a bloodhound for discerning the difference between this monolithic system and this interconnected system, and the way that they are sometimes clashing with each other in real time, but not only clashing, the way they're actually working together. It's almost like I'm watching this cultural handover in real time. It's like this monolithic system is a tired old man who's saying, I want to hand it to not an other individual idea of perfection, because the opposite of monolithic ism is not another singular ism. The opposite of being monolithic is everything else. And it kind of, I'm watching that handover. And one of the fun areas of tension, to tie it right down into a boots on the ground experience that I've seen multiple times when teaching, and I share this with you because I wonder if we could riff on it a little bit together, is watching people tie and rope mental stability, self-image, emotional congruence, and sense of clarity to their technical practices. And that when they run out of technique, it's like, I've got nothing, and it's a panic zone.
It's a panic,
And when I run out of feel, also a panic zone. It's that moment of standing in front of a horse and not knowing what to do now. And more I find myself with my regular clients who are in a safe container with me, and we really have that rapport that can facilitate it, is me not rushing in to fix it. Because when I rush in to fix it, I'm playing into monolithicism. I'm playing into, I'm cast as the hero. I'm playing into, here's the solution. It's another technique. And if you've got 16 techniques here, then you'll be able to avoid this. And what I'm leaning into is this feeling of everything, of sitting back and going, yeah, and actually saying, we need to love this moment. You've got to really be in love with the moment of standing in front of a horse and going, well, slap your thigh and say, I had no idea. And actually not, like, love that moment, because I think if we learn to love that moment, we'll see that not only is it no big deal, that the sky doesn't fall down and nothing bad is happening, but I think it builds in space for the horse to have an idea. Often that moment of, I don't know, we don't have to know, because often the horse does, and we're trying to cram the relationship with our answers. And what we need to do is listen rather than give more input. And I'm really kind of coaching and training myself and the people I work with regularly to love that moment, not to abdicate our responsibility to give technical instruction and lead people towards skill sets, but also not to neglect my responsibility to make sure people aren't playing into this old system, because this old system will bring us continually back to square one over and over again. The same problem. Like, I can't have people in circles with their horses where their relationship only goes well when they know what they're doing. I need them to be in a place where they have no idea and they're okay. Not only okay, they're thriving in that moment, and that the horse is thriving in that moment. Do you feel me? Do you want to, am I making any sense whatsoever? Because I feel like I'm slightly incoherent now.
No, and I feel like it actually, like, some of it's what you said, I feel like came out of my own mouth. Mm. Like, for example, I typically will share, you know, with anybody who has any interest in hearing my words, is that you really have to come to this place where you fall in love with the process and not what you think the end result is.
100%. Or can I step in there for 2 seconds?
Yes.
People want the process to look like the result.
Yeah, and it doesn't.
And it doesn't. A cake doesn't look like an egg, but an egg is involved in creating a cake. And so they're in the middle of the egg and they say, but it doesn't look like a cake. Yes, because we're in the process and it won't look like the result. Now have faith, right? Sorry to interrupt you.
Love that. I agree. And I think when people don't have the answers, somehow they feel like it's a reflection of who they are. Like, like, who am I beyond what I'm doing right now? And one of those teachers, again, I'm going to come back to Peggy. Like, Peggy would give me a few little exercises and she would say, now go play in the mud puddle. Mm. Experiment, right? Like, get curious. And also become very comfortable with being uncomfortable. Like being uncomfortable, we have a negative connotation around it. Whereas being uncomfortable, quite frankly, is where I've learned the most. It's like in those moments where the horse is looking at me with a big question mark, I'm looking at the horse with a big question mark. And then I hear Linda Tillington Jones say, isn't that interesting? Now what? I don't know what is next, but let's go play in the mud puddle and see what we can discover together. And quite frankly, we have far few answers than we actually think we have. And the other thing that I find very frustrating in some teachers that I've had in my life, or just watching education in general, is the thing that I am the absolute least interested in is creating a codependent relationship with somebody who wants to learn. We need to be able to have the opportunity to be in those uncomfortable moments, to think ourselves through something, have critical thinking thoughts about what might be happening here. And I think that one of the things that is so joyful for me at this point, let's just take something like shoulder in, right? I'll have a student come in and say, I want to work on shoulder in. Do you remember that exercise that we used to have in school where it says, okay, I'm going to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And then the teacher will say, now I want you to write down all the steps that you need to make before you can actually make the sandwich. Okay, well, I have to walk to the cupboard. I have to grab the peanut butter jar. I have to take the lid off. I have to put it down on the counter. I have to open the drawer. I have to take a knife out. Now I have to go get my bread loaf. You get the picture, right? And that's what I like to do with the horses is how can I chunk this idea of what I want to explore this idea or movement with my horse? How can I chunk that down to the smallest part and see if that part is, I can just work with that little part, that little chunk. And then, oh, well, now let's work on this little chunk and then let's layer those little chunks. And then, oh, after however long it takes, suddenly the shoulder in just falls into your lap because all of those little things came into play. But that requires the person to be present for the horse to have enough of a relationship with the human to have its own curiosity about the process and to feel safe. And then the joy of discovering what all those little pieces are and in like Jenga, putting all the little parts together. And then you're dancing in a way that wasn't forced or made to happen, but just organically happens. I love that. I love not knowing. I absolutely love not knowing. I think it's what keeps you going. If you knew everything, then what's the point?
Not knowing, right? Keeps us connected to feeling. It keeps us connected to the truth and words of our bodies. And if we can stay connected to the truth and words of our bodies without getting lost to it, we have half a chance to be connected to the truth and word of our horses' bodies in real time, I think.
I love that.
I hear you mention peanut butter and I get very excited because my last meal on earth is peanut butter toast. And, you know, like, sidebar, this is totally unrelated. Everywhere I go to clinic, people go, oh, Lockie Phillips' emotional horsemanship, he asked for peanut butter and black coffee. It's the only thing I ask for when I'm staying with the host. He's going to want that politically correct peanut butter. So we're going to the health food store and getting you something that was ground by Benedictine nuns. We're going to get you that stuff that tastes like cardboard. And what they don't understand is like, no, I need politically incorrect peanut butter. I need Skippy. I need gas station peanut butter. I need maybe it's adjacent to palm oil peanut butter. Like that's I need bad news peanut butter. That's my only problematic area I'm retaining consciously. Anyway, but I digress. You mentioned peanut butter and I get excited because I've got many peanut butter analogies. And one of the peanut butter analogies I have is that the horse is peanut butter because they are sandwiched between two slices of bread. You've got everyone's expectations on top of them, cultural expectations on top of them, the environment they're in, and you've got the people working with them, writing, caring, handling underneath, and they're sandwiched in between, and it's kind of a lose-lose situation for a lot of horses. That's one. The other one is, and this isn't, again, a monolithic feeling or noticing that I've noticed. It's something I've noticed from time to time and not in every instance. I meet a lot of people who know all the steps to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. They know, I got to go to the cupboard, I got to get the jar, I got to open everything you just mentioned. So they know how to create a shoulder in, they know how to start a horse under saddle, they know how to go into a competition, they know all of these things. But what they're finding, and I promise I'm going somewhere with this.
I do.
They're finding horses where they go to the cupboard to get the peanut butter and there's no peanut butter because no peanuts were grown. It was a crop failure at the peanut farm. They go to find the bread. There's no bread because there was crop failure in the wheat field. Or if they buy the bread, it's filled with toxic stuff because it was grown poorly in the wrong environment. You feel where I'm going with this? And the reason why I'm going into this is because my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that you were one of the first people in our field, because it's very popular to discuss it now, one of our first people in our field to bring awareness to genetic malformations in horses, such as ECVM, equine complex vertebral malformation, and others. You're one of the first people to just mention it, notice it, maybe even blow the whistle, where you're saying, we're going in, we know the steps, and I'm trying to make a peanut butter sandwich and there's no bread and there's no peanut butter. So what are we doing? It's kind of because the preceding steps, the environment, the actual horrible word, products aren't there for a lot of horses. They literally don't have the spoons. And so this leads us to a lot of reinterpretations or revisions around the practices that we embody. And also sometimes looking again with a discerning but not judgmental eye at some of our old masters we really look up to. How much was this a factor for them and they just didn't know? Or was this not a factor for them and it's a factor for us now? I don't know. What thoughts would you have to share on that? I don't have anything more specific to ask in this moment, but what thoughts would you have to share on that subject?
Well, you know, when we come to this idea of the masters, we can't really ever take out this idea that it was a different time,
right?
Different ideas around horsemanship, what horses meant to people. But I do think that there have always been people throughout history that are kind of operating, for example, from the very things that we're talking about. The very first treatise on horsemanship by Xenophon, when he talks about a dancer could never be made to dance beautifully through the use of spurs and whips. Why would it be different for the horse? Nothing beautiful can come out of coercion and force. So I think throughout history, we have had examples of this type of connection that we've talked about, even though horses may have had different purposes and different uses. You know, in the past, horses helped human beings evolve through their laborious efforts, whether it was taking people to war, whether it was delivering the post, transportation, building homes, planting fields, what have you. They were the beast of burden. And yet there was also this underlying subculture in different cultures and different areas and different times about how horses were more than just a beast of burden, but they were actually looked to as a way to develop ethically into good human beings. Charles de Comfy used to write pretty extensively about this, where nobility, the young men would be sent to work with horses because it made them better people, right? But I think a lot of the difference between the masters then in our contemporary efforts is that competition wasn't always a part of the relationship that we had with horses. I also believe that horses were looked to be more utilitarian, and now we do oftentimes look for more of an emotional connection with horses today. I think the masters used to live with horses. It was, you know, that's all they ever did. That's all they've ever known. And I think this idea of common horse sense is something of the past, because common horse sense isn't so common anymore. There's a lot of areas that, because people don't live with horses anymore, that we don't know maybe as intimately as maybe some of the masters of the past. I think they use their techniques. I think we've got the French school, we've got the Spanish school, we've got, you know, the German
Italian
school. We have all these different schools of thought for cultural reasons, for discipline specific reasons, and so forth. So we have all these different stylizations in even what people found beautiful, right? So there was a lot of opinion about what was right, but there wasn't a lot of scientific study to support it, other than what I would refer to as qualitative science, which is the quality of something through experience, soft science. We didn't have quantitative science that much or hard science to prove things. Today, we have access to what the master said, but we also have diagnostics that the masters never had. So
and
we have, and hard data. So we have to not look to the teachings of the people that came before us and then inform those teachings even more now with some of the data that we have, but yet we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater in that you still have to do your time. You still have to look to what these people learn from their horses, right? So I don't think that we throw it out, but I think we make it better. They give us a really good outline. And maybe they repeated it with more than one horse, you know, but they did it. They lived it. They breathed it. It's all they ever knew. And a lot of times in this industry, we have a hobbyist who wants to take their one specific horse by reading the masters and taking it all the way. But what these masters write about in their books doesn't talk about all the moments that are uncomfortable or the moments that don't go well. You're reading about the final product or the final process. It's very hard to capture all that in a book. It's hard to capture all of that life, all of that living, all of those moments in the written word, because so much of what we experience with our horses isn't a verbal language, and we try to put words to it. So I think it's dangerous to get caught up in just saying, oh, only the masters did A, B, and C, because I can look at the evolution of the Spanish riding school and say, that looks terrible, or that's moving in a good direction, and now this looks terrible again, depending on who the director of the Spanish riding school was, if we're just using that as an example. Or some people say, oh, yeah, you know, Boucher's first treaty sucked, but his second manner was good, right? So there's just all of this, like, theoretical debate. And I'm saying it's great, let the theory inform you, but it's not going to replace you just spending time with them.
And also something that I've seen a lot when reading the older masters myself is I'll read a few sentences and I'll go, oh, beautiful. Yeah, lovely. Oh, so nice. Oh, yeah. And then one sentence straight after I go, what? Excuse me?
Yeah.
And those sentences will be totally irrelevant. Those entire sentences, they'll write one sentence and it's very clear that those few words, those 12 words will represent decades of work and decades of nuance and thousands of hours of practice. And so, of course, we're dealing with a situation that's inherently reductive when we're reading their work. We're dealing with that. I never forget that. But I think where a lot of people get a little confused and a little tripped up is the inability to discern the difference between what's a problematic practice and what's worthy of our consideration and potentially picking up and working with today. And I've heard of some modern day teachers, clinicians, masters, if you will, do something very similar. There'll be a lot of rhetoric and practice that's very nice, very good. It's not only aesthetically pleasing, but from a process point of view, very good for the horse. And then sometimes even under the radar, there'll be something that slides in that's a little, for me, worthy of our attention and perhaps even pause for concern. And I think a lot of people, when they're in enraptured with a certain teaching style or with a certain body of work, will just take all of it at face value and absorb all of it. And it's very much then, in those situations, beholden to the teacher to make sure they're being extremely cautious with their own practice and have a robust relationship to the revision of their own work constantly, and a critical eye. If anyone's going to be judgmental of your work, you need to be of your own 100%. Work all the time. And that's where I see a lot of people get really stuck. I mean, I've had a couple of sentences I've actually said to students of mine, verbatim, insert their name here. Let's say their name was Sarah. It wasn't. I'd say, Sarah, the day you tell me to F off is the day I know I've done my job. You need to stop fawning over everything I say.
Yeah.
The day you tell me to F off. And we said it with humor with each other, right? Yes. And right, of course, right. she laughed. But the day you tell me to F off is the day I know I've done my job, because I need you to start thinking critically, especially about things I'm teaching you to, because I'm not infallible, right? And so it's very clear you've got a robust relationship to revising your own work. But for those of us outside looking in, could you try and give us an insight into what that actually looks like as a horsewoman, as Jillian to Jillian, as Jillian to her horses, as Jillian to her student body, as Jillian to your art? How do you revise? How do you work that?
Yeah. Like I said, I think many of us, whether it's through technique or becoming involved in a method, we look to the method or the technique to have all the answers. And what I've tried to really stay away from is, you know, somebody will say, oh, you should, you know, with your in-hand work, you should create a method. And that just makes me cringe, because I have seen a handful of really good people who created a method, and then they've actually outgrown their very own method. And then people hold them to their original method. Well, you used to say A, B, and C. And then it takes me back to the study of my own research ethics and research philosophy. And that is, when you produce research, one of your number one goals in research is for someone to poke holes in your research, because that's how you get better. Okay, there's A, B, and C were great about your research, but D, E, and F, there's some big holes and some big gaps here, or that was just straight up wrong. So let's go back now and backfill that, and then add more to it so that your knowledge base is operating from a more solid foundation. So I think methods tend to trap people and pigeonhole thought into a nice, tidy little package. And it's just not that. It just isn't, because something may work for one individual relationship that you have with a horse and not at all with the next. So I think getting trapped by a method is really, really dangerous. And for those people who do have methods, for their students to have an understanding that those instructors are going to grow at some point beyond what they originally stated. So I think you have to really, and we've already hit upon this, is really embrace that you were wrong and maybe change something. You know, when it was not an easy thing, Lockie, when I went from, it wasn't like I just flipped a switch where I went, oh, today I use dominating techniques. I break my back. Now, tomorrow I'm going to be all ooey, wooey, glee, right? It didn't happen like that, because if you're practicing a way that you've learned and it's ingrained in you, and you have it in your muscles and you have it in your own wiring, in your own neural anatomy, you have your own neural pathways that if horse does A, I'm going to react with B, because that's my own myelinization and my own path and my own pattern that I had in my whole nervous system. So what would happen is, after I knew I needed to have some sort of shift in my own work, you know, I would go and work with the horse, and I may have firmed up too much with the horse. And then I would go into the house and I would like emotionally crucify myself. I would flog myself. I would beat myself up. I thought, I went from one end of the spectrum to the other end of the spectrum. I'm a piece of shite. You know, I'm never going to be any good. I suck. You know, just all of this very negative self-talk. So what I started doing is I started putting pictures up in the arena of people that I really admired. And when I would play with a horse, and if it would go a little sideways, instead of me tapping into that old pattern, I would say, oh, Peggy's watching me, or Mark's watching me, or whoever's watching me. And it would give me just enough pause to make a different decision. And slowly, very slowly, I started to rewire my own pattern. And I wrote a post recently about what the word grace means.
Because
a lot of social media, when we see somebody do something wrong, it's very easy for us to judge and to make, you know, to become social media bullies or to shame people. And it's not that those people should not be held accountable, but I don't think shaming if the person is trying to make a change. Now, that's what we don't know. We don't know where this person came from. We don't know what their experience was. Heck, if you had put me on social media 25 years ago, I'd be one of those people. But my ability to change took time, and it took a conscious effort, and I had to rewire my entire system. And that can be very, very painful. And so I think we have to have grace for ourselves. We have to have grace for the people that we learn from. We have to have grace for our horses. And I'm not extending grace to people who don't want to change. The worst for me is when they know it's not good and they choose it anyway. That's very hard for me.
Say that bit.
Yeah.
Right. That bit is so important to say. Yeah.
Yeah. I will extend as much grace and empathy towards anybody who is just trying to make a better decision, and they might struggle in that process, because I was very much one of those people. What is hard for me is when you know what you're doing is harmful and you still make the conscious choice to continue. Mm. And I'm very lucky, Lockie, because the people who come and learn from me are typically people who want to do right by their horses. So I feel like I live in this amazing bubble of yumminess. But then I might go with Casey, my partner, and she'll go teach, or let's say trim or something at a Western Pleasure performance barn. And I walk in there, and every single horse's head is tied around to their saddle, and they stand there for 4 hours. And I think to myself, I need to see this, because I didn't really think this still happens, but it does still happen.
Oh yeah, it's the norm.
You know, it's just the norm, and I need to remind myself that these things happen. And again, it's very hard for me not to be judgmental and these people, this is bad or whatever. I have to have a little bit of grace. Quite honestly, I don't think they do know that there's a different way. This is what they do to create this. They go out, they win the ribbon, it works. They don't give it a second thought. But then there are those who want to change. And I will share this one story quickly, because I think it's important in terms of finding if we are in that process of shifting from one paradigm to the other, is that it does take time and it does take grace and forgiveness of ourselves along that journey as well. But when I had mentioned in the beginning, when I had that accident, prior to the accident, you know, I had this big overinflated ego. I just thought I knew so much. And then you realize you don't know Jack. Well, then the pendulum swung the other way. So when I would go out and I would make a mistake, then I would abuse myself, you know, the inside voice. It just, you know, literally, it was like flogging myself. And I really don't know what gave me the courage to go back to the barn again, because when I made a mistake, I would just re-experience those horrible feelings over and over again. But there was something so deep in me that wanted to evolve my own experience with these amazing sentient beings. And I was sharing that story with my friend Andy, you know, about how, you know, I went from one end of the pendulum to the other end of the pendulum. Like, yeah, I was, you know, so arrogant. I thought I knew all this stuff. I was full of self-righteousness. And then the pendulum swung to the other side where I just, like, I loathed myself. And I'm like, it's so hard to be in this space where I don't believe in myself and this and that, whatever. And he gently grabbed my hands and he says, you realize you're still making it all about you. You're just making it about you in the other direction. And boy, now if that wasn't authenticity and truth, I don't know what was. And he was correct. I went from one end of the speculum to the other end of the speculum, and neither served myself or the horses in my life. And somehow, you know, you kind of find this middle ground, and I can vacillate. I still kind of vacillate more over here where I don't know anything. But I can welcome that now. Not as a good or a bad thing, but just this is what is happening. And if I could share that with people on this journey, I think that you have to go through your own process and find your own middle that holds the truth for you, and not be codependent on all of these different methods. Sure, they're there to guide us, but not any one person or any one method offers all the answers, you know? Like, I think the healthiest horsemanship relationships between people are the ones that can say, you know, I love that you do this and this and this, but I'm not sure about this. I'm going to put what you taught me about that in the parking lot right now, because it doesn't quite resonate with me in my gut, from my own senses, or I can't quite make sense of it in my mind. And that instructor can say, that's great. Sit with it. See how that resonates. You don't have to agree with me. Or you don't have to shame somebody if they don't agree with you. I think that's healthy. And, you know, one of my teachers, Manolo, always, you know, says to me, Jill, if you really want to understand horses more, you have to study all creatures. You have to study the natural world around you and the universe. You have to study all of those things to help you understand yourself better and the horse. And that's been a guiding light and principle for me.
Mm. I'm going to yes and on this this subject here if I can.
Yeah, absolutely.
The subject of methodology. And I think the criticism, skepticism, and ick around organized methodology in the horse world, in the equestrian sector, is well earned. Because you and I, off the record, could sit here and calmly, without being judgmental, fill a page of names of people who went the quote-unquote methodological route. I have a method, follow my method, it'll solve your problems, right? Mm-hmm. It's the George Foreman grill notion of horse training, right? It's the home shopping network. It's the home shopping network version of horsemanship, which came out of predatory marketing tactics from the 80s through the 90s. And we all got a little wise to it. And now we're all a little method shy, like horses who are spur shy or whip shy or ear shy. We're all a little method shy. And I think for good reason. And Jill, if I can call you Jill,
please.
I teach a method and I have no qualms using the word method. Bald, plain, and true. Now, I'm also aware that when I invoke the word method, I'm going to all of these emotional projections from the community at large about what it is to see a dude in a hat, particularly a dude in a hat representing a method. He's a sellout. He's gone too deep into marketing. He's trying to take my money. He's going to take me up the garden pathway and abandon me there. He's lost all of his integrity. He's too organized. It's too slick. I can't trust it. This isn't for the horse and all of that. And I understand that. I understand that projection. And I believe those projections are well earned in the horse world for good reason. And I'm aware that they are traumatic projections that have nothing to do with what I mean, intend, and actually impact in people's lives when I use the word method, when I use the word method. The same way I say I'm a horse trainer, but I don't look like a 30, 60, 90 day cold starter. I don't look like someone who trains horses for the public. And I have no problem in an elevator telling someone I'm a horse trainer. Oh, so you do X, Y, and Z? No. Oh, so you do X, Y, and Z? No. I go down to my local agricultural vet and they say, you have horses, right? I say, yes, you work with horses. Yes, this is all in Spanish, of course. And they say, so you breed? No, I don't breed.
No.
You sell? No. You go to competitions? No. So what do you do? I say, it's complicated. I'm a horse trainer. That's all. Can I buy my medicine and leave now, right? So I'm not interested in perpetuating any traumatic storylines around any semantics in the horse world. I am interested in giving people an opportunity to have a different experience around organized methodology. And this is why. Because you mentioned earlier, though, that you are surrounded in a bubble of deliciousness, yumminess, you said. A bubble of yumminess with your clientele. I am too. I very intentionally chose an echo chamber, but I chose the echo chamber that I can sleep at night being inside of. Knowing also that 2x4 trainers exist and nose to the cantle trainers still exist out there, and that's the norm. I know that. So I'm in an echo chamber and I'm aware of it. In my echo chamber, the people I meet, if they spent time in the abusive horse training world, it was pretty brief. If they spent time there at all, or if they spent a lot of time there, they're very, very clear now that they disidentify with it. So they're not even close to identifying with abusive practices anymore. In fact, some of them have been 20 years outside of those systems. And for 2 years, they've been in a fog where their horsemanship is disorganized, haphazard, unclear for themselves and their horse. And there's no clear path forward, no clear path with their technical application, no clear path with their identity, no clear pathway for community, for purpose, for enjoyment, no clear path. We've gone from a clear path, which was abusive, to a foggy path. And we're on the foggy path, basically saying methodology is not to be trusted, which is saying clarity is not to be trusted when you're in a fog. But when you're in a fog, you need the fog to clear. When you're in the fog, you need a guideline. When you're in the fog, you need structure. And so what I recognized is that people need methodology, but they don't need the methodology they used to have. And they don't need the methodology that creates the same cultural pitfalls. They need methodology in the same way they need a framework to work with, but that framework never strangles them or the horse to be a square peg into a round hole. The actual structure of the methodology must build in thinking and observational skills first. That is, before any technique, you need to be able to observe the horse and think for yourself before you use any step-by-step process at all. The very notion of being in an organized methodology means that if you've got a leader, particularly if they are male, and particularly if they are a white male, which I have two pieces of privilege I didn't earn. I'm white and I'm male. If I was heterosexual, I would already have my indoor arena.
True, you would.
I would, straight up. Yeah. I would already have the tie-ins. I would already have the connections. I'd already have the acceptance of people who will never accept me. But I digress. I've got two pieces of privilege. And if I'm a white male in an organized methodology, my role is to decenter myself as frequently and often as possible and yield ground to women, people of color, other minorities, and to yield ground to community-sourced information as much as possible. And so that's low-key what Lockie is doing over here, is actually trying to get people off this traumatic notion of what methodology is or what it should be, and actually try to use that in a way that's for good. And it's hard to do, and I think I'm going to fail at doing it over and over again. I think I'm going to make loads of mistakes. And in fact, I probably should fail at it. I probably should make loads of mistakes doing it, because that's part of the medicine, actually. Because the more I fail and the more I make mistakes at it, the more I step back and yield to the intelligence of others. And that's what organized method failed at, pun intended. Yeah. Am I making any sense, or am I incoherent again? I don't know.
No. You're making perfect sense. And I love it because it's taking me into a place of thinking more deeply about it. And then it comes back to a matter of semantics, right? So, you know, I think what methodology can offer ourselves and offer students in the community is exactly what you said. It's an outline.
Right.
And I think in terms of a methodology, an outline is really great. Mm. However, an outline turns into a rough draft, right? So maybe you need to search a little here and search a little here and search a little here to write your first chapter. But that chapter was based upon an outline.
Right.
And so I think many methodologies do offer that.
Yeah, you do. You do.
Where
you appear very methodologically driven, very clear, very, very structured.
Very clear. Absolutely. Like, you know, when people come learn, I just don't call it a method. I say, you know, when I approach many horses, these are what I call my pre-flight checks. These are some things I want to have in place in order to move forward. There might be 100 different ways of moving forward, but these are what I look for. So whether you call it an approach, a system, a method, I think every instructor
needs structure.
Then prescribes to something of that nature. So is it just a matter of semantics? Maybe. And I think it also matters upon the person who is offering that. Like, you seem to me to be a person, I mean, I don't know you, but my impression is that you don't always have to have a hard edge. You can kind of walk that edge and say, well, yeah, I can see a little bit over here and I can see a little bit over here. I'm going to fail at this, so I might adapt and change, right? And you'll bring your people along with that adaptation and that change. But sometimes people get very comfortable in a method and become uncomfortable with the person changing and growing themselves. And I think that's where we sometimes get like a little stuck, let's say, right?
Yeah.
Like we can get stuck in our own way. And we also find ourselves in such a unique and a different time because so many people do get their information from social media platforms. Like when I first grew up, like if you wanted to learn something about horsemanship, it wasn't that you sat down and read a book about it, or you went to Google and learned about it, or you asked ChatGPT about it. You actually went and apprenticed with somebody. that you respected. And I'm kind of sad sometimes for the younger generations coming up, because I had a lot of opportunity to go study with a lot of different people and just to immerse myself with all different types of people. There were a lot of apprenticeships that were available. And I think that there are fewer and fewer opportunities for people to become apprentices where they get to stay for a year or 2 years and really to submerge themselves in that process. Economics play a big role in it. I was willing to live like a pauper most of my life because I was so hungry to learn. But I see fewer and fewer of those opportunities being given to people. And I think in terms of pedagogy, I would like to see more of that, like places for people to go get experience, mm-hmm. as opposed to just learning it from a computer or a video. And that surely has its place. Surely has its place to learn from videos and on a social media platform. But you also need to have the application, especially since COVID. I have a lot of people who are theoretically extremely clever. They know it. They understand it. They can say it. But when they have a horse, they haven't owned it in their own body yet. And so I really feel it's important to have a healthy blend and to have opportunities for people to have the application experience.
Yes.
To inform their knowledge.
Yeah, body intelligence, not just monolithic abstract mental intelligence at the same time. And the sad fact is that ChatGPT could probably teach better lessons than some instructor these days. And that's a little sad too, because we're losing pedagogical excellence, which is also tied into this issue with around pathological methodologicalism. People misunderstanding methodology, being bad pedagogues. You know, I've made several courses, online courses like yourself, and each course sort of springs off from the next one and goes a little deeper and a little wider and then a little deeper and then a little wider. And the first one is very simple. The second one, it's almost step by step. It's almost comfortable. It's almost compartmentalized. And then the third one, it's like, hang on a minute, you're blowing the boxes apart. And I've actually had students come to clinics and say, well, I really came to this clinic because I loved that course you did and everything was tied up in these little boxes. And I was kind of expecting that to happen here today. And I just go, and it didn't, because it shouldn't. And you shouldn't expect that of me now. We actually need to expand all the time, expanding, because I'm not going to not teach something structured, because people are going to get stuck. Someone who's going to get stuck is going to get stuck no matter what you do with them. And that's a transient tendency that will land anywhere, like a seed in the wind. It's going to land anywhere, whether you're structured in your teaching or not. Anyway, we could keep going on, but I do want to respect your time because you've been so generous with your time. If you can, you've already nodded to it, but what gives you hope about the future of horse training and horsemanship? What gives you hope?
Yeah, I think that technology offers us as a community to offer kinder, more informed ways of being. And then that translates to being with horses. I think there's a lot more opportunity to learn from that perspective today than there ever has been. What gives me hope is when I started teaching functional anatomy 18 years ago, it was to two women, maybe three women in someone's living room. Now, you know, maybe we have a bigger class, 40 or 60 people, of people wanting to learn how to be better stewards, how to really go deeper into the ship, the fellowship, the stewardship, the friendship, the horsemanship part of the journey. I think young people have access to knowledge through technology that I never had, if they go digging deep enough. And I do think that there are more and more people who are seeking a different way than I recognized 20 years ago. And that gives me hope for not just horses, but for humans, for the human condition to question. I think there is more of a culture that is accepting of vulnerability that was maybe seen as a weakness before. And, you know, you and I both know that in order to expand, you have to be vulnerable. And you don't have to have all the answers. In fact, if you think you have all the answers, you know, there's a glitch someplace. So I do have hope that we can evolve with horses in a different way than maybe we have in the past, and that's becoming more commonplace and not just left to the woo-woo minded people. You know, like that used to be a negative thing. Now it's like, oh, I'm cool because I'm woo or whatever. But I do think that there's a part of the human condition that many of us are seeking for more quiet, not as much noise, more stability, a way to slow down. And I think more and more people realize that they can actually find that place with horses, not doing something to the horse, but just the fact that we are with horses offers us that fascinating possibility to search for a better emotional, spiritual, and mental place, which I think the horses offer us. Yeah.
Go on.
Mm-hmm. I was just coming because I'm like reflecting back to the methodology part of it. I think what method does offer us is a platform or a springboard. And then we've got to like dive off of that and develop ourselves from that place.
It's the woo-ification of methodology. Mm-hmm. The only thing I don't like woo is my peanut butter. I don't want woo peanut butter. It's the only thing I need problematic. I want problematic old school peanut butter. That's what I'm needing. Jill, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. And when we meet, I'm going to make you a JK special.
Okay, what's that?
Special is Jiffy peanut butter.
Love.
A little bit of Hershey's chocolate.
Damn.
Ice cream.
Wow.
And you mix it all together, and then you drizzle heavy cream over the top of it. JK special, just for you.
Elvis Presley could never. My arteries are already closing in anticipation.
Now I want one right now.
Yeah.
For breakfast.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Bad influence.
Oh, my God. Well, you got to influence something. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I've had a great time. Have a lovely rest of your day.
You too, and thank you for doing what you're doing. I truly believe you're making some very good and profound ripples, so thank you.
Good and profound ripples or pissing people off? Both I'll take. Both I'll take.
Both, yeah, go for it.
All right, take care now.
Thank you, Lockie. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
And that's all for today. If something in this episode made an impact on you, I encourage you to take it with you to your next moment with your horse, because that's where this work and these conversations really come alive in what you do next. If you would like to support this podcast, a simple way to do that is by leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon. It would help more people to find these conversations, and it would mean a lot to me. Horse First with Lockie Phillips is the formerly Emotional Horsemanship podcast and is distributed by the Believe Audio and Video Network. And just a gentle reminder, the content of this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. The opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests and are not a substitute for professional, veterinary, or medical advice. I'm Lockie Phillips. Thank you for listening.